Welcome back to episode 118 of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Kalusic, releasing a new episode every Wednesday. This week, we have the pleasure of speaking with Richard Armstrong. Richard is a venture partner at TA Ventures based in Southeast Asia, identifying promising ventures in emerging markets with a particular emphasis on consumer technology and marketplaces. With over 5 years of experience in startups and venture capital, Richard has a rich background on the creator and media side and is a two-time founder himself. His expertise in media and technology has led him to become an angel in over 70 companies worldwide. Richard's specialty lies in guiding founders with go-to-market and marketing strategies. Be sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review on our channel as it helps us continue to grow within the region and around the world. We hope you enjoy the episode. Richard Armstrong, welcome to Rising Giants. We are very excited to have you on the show today. Thank you for taking the time to spend with us to cover the VC landscape in Thailand, across Southeast Asia, your background. You're currently a venture partner at TA Ventures, leading the emerging markets efforts there. And I think a great place to start is, tell us what's going on. What are you currently working on at TA Ventures?
Yeah, man. Really appreciate, you guys both having me on. I think, it's heard many good things about your podcast from some of my portfolio companies, as well as, some close friends, right? So, thanks for having me on. And yeah, look, I mean, I'll give a bit of an intro about me first, right? Born in Thailand, grew up in quite a few countries around the world, lived in Australia, lived in New Zealand, Malaysia, England, Ireland, right? So as you probably imagine, living in all these countries from an early age, you get a strong understanding of, people, technology, things like that. So, I've been extremely grateful for the opportunity, started as an entrepreneur, two times founder, been angel investing, probably over like 70 companies now. And then, now I've been in the VC ecosystem for some time. Yeah, as I say, at TAV now. Happy to share a bit about TAV later and a bit of what I'm doing. And if you guys have any questions in here and there.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, thanks for that background. And maybe going back to the start of your journey.
So let me share a bit about, my background, right, mm-hmm. in terms of in general. So having been a two times founder, the first company was purely bootstrapped. We just helped scale that up and things like that. We were working with some of the big creators and things like this and big media platforms in the region. So, this was a profitable business, right? We didn't raise any VC money. Great model. We helped it scale here and there. And then, so that was my first business. The second company was actually a food waste company. I was more of an investor there, as they say, helped them scale up, did all the fundraising here and there. I was more like a first investor, but also co-founder, right? And then, delved into the investment angle, angel investing for some time. And then, did quite a lot of deals around the world, as well as in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And then, ended up at TAV, right? So I've sort of been on the founder side, seeing firsthand as well how founders are and how founders, operate, right? And then what I realized in, along my journey is that, it was very hard to raise capital, right? And, I wanted to, being an outsider as well at the beginning, it was super hard to raise money. So I sort of saw the angle was like, okay, how I can give back to founders and things like this is, okay, if I'm on the other side of the table, I can help open the door for them, right? Especially in a market like Thailand where capital isn't as readily available as the US, right? So yeah, that's a bit about how I landed in, venture, right? I mean, a lot of people managed to help me quite a bit as well in terms of, I helped quite a few people and then, a lot of people would help you in return, right? So it's sort of like giving back in a way and also, helping take good opportunities. So yeah, that's a bit about how I landed and, my journey from the startup side to the venture side. So yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned about specifically around fundraising. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of those challenges that you face as a founder and those learnings that you were able to take to now supporting other founders as an investor when they explore options for fundraising?
Yeah, look, I mean, I can talk about maybe from the founder lens and I can talk to the investor lens as well, raising for my portfolio companies here and there. Firstly, from the founder lens, right? At the beginning, I had no clue how to raise money. As I said, I just thought, oh, okay, it'll be easy, right? You talk to one or two people and, they'll give you a check, right? That's not the case, man. So Look, I think in the first, like as I say, my second company, because the first company was just bootstrapped, right? Their second company, we talked to everyone. Like, I think we had about like, you know, over like 200 meetings with just investors and things like this. And, you know, a few said yes, and a lot of them said no, right? And didn't get it. But that's, I guess, it's a numbers game, right? With, you know, in venture. So it's like you talk to as many and then one or two would say yes. So that was actually like a hard lesson. And, you know, maybe we could have figured out ways how to, okay, maybe raise money earlier and raise more money than less money, you know, so to give us more runway. So anyways, it was lessons learned, right? And then on the advisory side, advising a few companies, I always tell my founders that, you know, we should raise, as they say, only what we need, right? Because what sort of happened in 2021 was, you know, a lot of my founders as well in 2022, right? More 2021, late 2021, right? You know, they were like, oh yeah, we got this term sheet, we got this, you know, deal. And I'm like, okay, what's the terms? And they're like, yeah, it's really good, right? And then, okay, you know, but this valuation is much, much higher and things like that. And I'm like, okay, you guys think you can grow into that? And a lot of them said, I'm not sure, right? But they're giving us money. So I think it's more to say, like, you know, there's, if you have a few options on the table, you should really consider that. And, you know, you should say, not take the most expensive deal, but sorry, not take the highest valuation, but more or less, you know, one, as I say, what do you think it could be something realistic for you, right? Because, I mean, I know some companies as well, some of my portfolio companies that raise at astonishing high prices, and I don't know if they'll ever get there, right? So, yeah, I would say just taking those learnings and helping founders, you know, set up, like, you know, just meeting investors and setting up, you know, fundraising plans here and there. So, yeah, got to help them quite a bit there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you brought up of maybe not wanting to raise at the highest valuation because they're, and asking the question of, can you grow into it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that would be interesting to explore on, you know, in this conversation a little bit about how you're able to help a founder from an advisor role justify not taking more money and instead taking what makes most sense for the business. I'm sure, you know, from a lot of founders' perspectives, they're like, well, oh, we have all this money in front of us. Like, why would you not take it? And as an advisor, how do you help justify that to them?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things, right? I mean, you want to see what firstly is good for not just, as I say, you as the individuals, right? What is good for your employees as well, right? Because, I mean, you know, so there's multiple factors you can consider. As I say, that's the main one. The second thing, as I say, is that, for example, does this money give you what it takes to hit milestones, this next milestone, right? And then sort of then go from there step by step. Because, I mean, venture has always been this sort of ecosystem where, you know, you get to from pre-seed and then, you know, you hit X amount of milestones and you raise your seed and then you raise your Series A and then you raise your, you know, Series B and then onwards, right? But I think, you know, that's, you know, beginning to change as well. You know, I think founders are needing less money now to raise. I mean, like, I'm speaking to founders right now. I have some founders in my portfolio that, you know, they might just need one or two rounds of funding, right? I hope, because me as an investor, I don't want that dilution, right? I don't want to be diluted to bits. So, I mean, look, I mean, I would rather prefer that. And I mean, so a lot of companies are now starting to focus more on profitability quite early, especially at the very earliest stages. If not, I mean, not profitability, but also solid unit economics, right? Or solid gross margin, things like this. And then, you know, as they scale their business, you know, it only could get better. So yeah.
Yeah. And from the angel side, because you've done quite a bit of angel investing, do you prefer to have more of a hands-on approach to investing or keeping an arm's length distance in that sense? So thinking of it, maybe whether it's, if you don't necessarily have, do you push for more having an advisory position with the company, or trying to maybe incorporate some sort of sweat element to the investment?
Yeah, look, I think it's a combination of things, right? I think it's, you know, firstly, you put them into two buckets, right? I guess it's sort of how can you be best helpful for the founder? I think the first bucket is, you know, one, you know, you say that, okay, this founder needs you a lot. They may be a first-time founder or, you know, never raised money before, but they have this great idea, you know, and they have some solid traction, right? So I think that's the first bucket, you know, and they're going to need you a lot. And, you know, you're going to have to help them with fundraising here and there. You know, maybe you're going to help them, you know, with marketing, whatever they need, right? And then the second bucket is, you know, you just back these second or third or fourth time founders that, you know, have had multi-hundred-million-dollar exits or back or, you know, been founders of these brilliant businesses. And then you just say, okay, how can I help? Okay, I can give you a few intros here and there. This is what you need. And then they just get back to building. Right. So you put them, I have both buckets where, okay, some of them I just catch up monthly and it's like, what do you call it? So it's like maybe a 30-minute chat, 45-minute chat. And they tell me, hey, I want to speak to this person. I want to speak to this person. I want to speak to this person. Can you help set it up? You know, and then the other bucket is, hey, I need your help here on this marketing plan. Or I need, you know, as they say, I need you to help me with a fundraising plan. I wish, you know, who to speak to, come up with a list with me, blah, blah, blah. So there's more that hand-holding approach as well. So yeah, those are the two buckets.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good way to segment it between those two sides. Because from Max and I's experience as well, we've seen that actually on both sides, there's the far more hands-on experience. And there's also the, hey, we'll schedule an hour-long call every month just to give you an update and answer any questions that you're having, which is completely fine too. You know, you want to let the founders build and build and you know, in the way that they need to build. So in terms of bringing it up to current day, what is, and at TA Ventures, what is your experience like since joining the fund? And what are some of the things that you're currently focusing on and are most excited about?
Look, I think with TAV, right, maybe let me share a bit about, you know, TAV and, you know, what we've done. So as they say, you know, we're on to fund three right now. A bit about TAV. TAV has done 220 investments to date. Out of those 220 investments, we've been able to exit around 70. You know, we've had 6 IPOs, you know, 12 unicorns. So pretty strong, right? I mean, you're in the US, right, Dom? So you probably heard of, you know, Cambrian, Adore Me, you know, and then Europe, Impress, SumUp. You know, these are 100 million, like even multi-billion dollar companies, right? We were early investors in them. So I guess, you know, what really drove me to have being in a name like TAV was not just their brand name, but also, you know, their track record, right? And what I like about them is, you know, that really aligned with me as well as a like, you know, being on the operator side and being an entrepreneur as well. So that really clicked. And also the fund size, right? I really viewed them as not just like a more an asset manager, but, you know, really, as they say, a fund, you know, which they raise like 30, 35 million, things like this. And, you know, they generate strong returns for their investors, right? And I want to be associated with somewhere where, you know, I can eventually, you know, be part of the long-term journey, but, you know, benefit in the long-term upside as well. Cause I think that's what venture should always be about, right? You know, if you win, you should always win together and things like that. So yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I also just wanted to touch on like maybe how your angel investment experience kind of set the stage for you, like now working with a VC. So, I mean, just looking at some of the companies that you've invested in a personal capacity, I think we've seen like you did HD, Odin, CryoShop, Convi, Frontman, Kona Brands, just to name a few. And you said that you've done, I guess, nearly 70 or so far.
Probably over 70 now, probably over 70. Yeah, yeah.
And so what are the ones that stand out as like the big successes? And what do you think you got right in those? And then maybe on the other end of it, the ones that didn't quite work out, and like how do you explain that, and what are some of the lessons on both sides of that, success and failure?
Yeah, so look, you know, maybe you talk about the good ones first, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, I mean, for I think venture is, you know, this sort of 7 to 10 year, even longer outcome, right? Especially where we're investing, you know, sometimes we're investing on a deck or, you know, very, very strong, you know, founders, right, that just have this amazing idea and they say, hey, I want to build this, right? So, I mean, you know, maybe we can talk about the companies I'm quite excited for. Firstly, I mean, you talk about HD, right? That's a company I'm very, very close with where, you know, these are top founders. You know, one of the co-founders came from e-commerce, one of the leading, like, as you say, e-commerce enablers in Southeast Asia, you know, run rates of hundreds of millions. And then, you know, the other one ran, as I say, as CFO and helped incubate like a lot of like companies like Acom and a bunch of others, right? So really strong track record. So, I mean, I invested in them in like a couple years back. And what really interested me about them was that, you know, whenever the VC ecosystem was very hot, right, everyone was backing, you know, the next telehealth company or whatever, you know, in terms of, you know, telehealth was very hot, right? Okay. But for me, I was like, okay, this, you know, this didn't really make sense, because I was actually an investor in a company like Teladoc, right? And Teladoc, you know, I watched Teladoc rise and, you know, the downfall as well, right? So even before the Livongo acquisition. And then, you know, what sort of realized to me is like, hey, you know, if these multiples of this, why are these companies in Asia getting these, you know, really bloated, or even in other emerging markets getting these bloated multiples, right? So I sort of saw that. I was like, okay, this didn't really make sense. And I saw HD as sort of a, in a way, sort of this counter to it, right? So their model was sort of this, like, you know, marketplace, and then they have this like AWS model on the healthcare side, and then they've actually started doing into like this Pristine Care model as well, in the, you know, which is a company in India, so their own like a private label and things like that. So really bullish on them, really excited them. I mean, a lot of investors at that time told me, was like, oh, why investing in this company, you know, just back telehealth, right? But I was like, okay, you know, I'm backing the founders here. I like what they're building. It's very exciting. I mean, and yeah, you know, they at the beginning, it was a bit hard to close that bridge. Definitely. I mean, I helped them raise as well here and there. But yeah, I mean, they're planning to announce their new funding round. So, you know, happy of that. And yeah, it's a good lead. And I think people are starting to see it now, right? Well, you know, the valuation, the unit economics, the model is actually really working, and they're doing really well in Thailand. So that's the first one. Another company, Odin, right? I mean, you talk about Odin, right? What really interested me there was I spent some time with the Odin founder, right? And then, as they say, I actually used a few SPVs through their platform as well, set up a few. And I think what really interests me about Odin was like, hey, in the US, we have AngelList, right? We don't really have anything in Europe or Southeast Asia or these other markets, right? And the beauty of Odin, I guess, you know, they want to sort of be this social, like, investing platform, as they say, for your typical, more social aspect to, I guess, AngelList, right? Sort of democratizing that access to funding. And that's what I like about them. And, you know, they allow, let's say, me or you were to start a company in tomorrow, right? We can be in anywhere in the world, and we can raise money from, and we can pull capital together, and it could be very, very quick, right? So I think before this wasn't able to do, and now they've just allowed, you know, Odin has just, you know, been this sort of next growth driver for more, you know, deals being done, democratizing that access as well. So yeah, those are the two exciting ones. And I mean, I'll give you another example. Back to a brilliant business in India, right? You know, this is very, very early. I'll give you an example of like the founder backing the founder, right? So this company in India is actually in stealth right now. But yeah, I can share the name. But in terms of a company called N Plus Labs, right? A brilliant founder. I mean, you know, at I think 13, he was mentored by at 13, he was selling software to like Indian businesses. Think about that. At like 15, he did like the largest blood drive in India. At 16, you know, he was mentored by the president of India for that, right? And at 19, he was, you know, found out about Stanford, and he was like, hey, you know, this is pretty cool. I want to go there. You know, he hadn't heard of Stanford before, and he's like, yeah, why not? And then, so he paid his way through Stanford with his money he's made in the software company at, you know, at young age. And then now, as they can say, what do you call it? He came to me and was like, you know, I'm raising a bit of capital, and was like, oh, I want to build something like the next gen of entertainment for India, right? And for me, what really interests me was him, the individual. I think seeing the resilience of this person. So these are the things we look for at the early stage, right? So those are a few examples. And I guess some not so good examples, right, was back to, you know, during the crypto upturn, things like this. I mean, crypto's back, but let's see for how long, you know. But in terms of right now, there was a company I backed a few years ago. It was a company called Zigloo in the UK, Europe, right? So what sort of happened there was that, you know, the crypto market was super hot. Bitcoin was going to the moon, you know, and we were all super excited, right? And sort of they were building like the equivalent of I guess, a ZipMex, whatever you'd have in Asia for Europe, right? And what actually happened was that during the height of the bull market, crypto, you know, was going all-time highs. And then this company, which I invested in, like at Seed, it was like, hey, we got it. Like, as I say, it was all announced. And Robinhood, you know, after they IPO'd and stuff like this, was like, hey, you know, we want to buy this company for $200 million, right? And then what sort of happened was that, you know, it was great. And everyone thought the deal was going through. And then it took longer than expected. And I mean, it would have been like a really good return in the like 18-month period I was holding it, right? And, you know, very strong founding team and things like this. But I mean, that's just maybe an example of the market not heading the right direction. Yeah, I mean, as you probably know, that deal didn't go through. I mean, it fell apart. I don't know if it's even worth 10 now, to be honest. But, you know, I think, especially after with FTX and all these things, right? So look, I mean, maybe they restructure and they figure it out, but that's an example of, I guess, looking at other businesses, right? So learning from, I guess, other aspects. So sometimes, you know, you not just need the founder, but you need the right timing as well, right? I guess on this crypto one, it was a good founder, but the timing was, you know, it was up, but the time of closing of, you know, the acquisition was later, right? So yeah, I'd say those are probably a few examples to give.
Mm. And just like on that, would you say there are any particular red flags or green flags that you can identify in kind of people's personalities or their just general like characteristics that you've kind of have been good feelings over time to give you that better kind of sense of who's heading in the right direction or not?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think you can't take that one size fits all approach, right? I mean, I think it's going to have to be like case by case, each company, you know? But I mean, maybe talk about the green flags first. I mean, you know, the green flags, obviously, you know, like founder market fit, you know, this person has, you know, been in the maybe a similar industry, but maybe this is more just a tech enabled approach, right? He's, you know, maybe this expert in X, Y, and Z, but he's looking at a more tech enabled version of X, Y, and Z, right? And he's the best person to solve it. I guess the second thing is, you know, maybe they've just experienced the pain problem like very, very well. And like, you know, you're like, okay, whenever you see them, they're like, okay, they're the right fit for this. So the founder market fit is very important. And then, you know, other green flags would be like, you know, not necessarily more on, okay, what are their numbers like? You know, their traction, things like this. But I guess for us, what traction probably matters a bit less than what I guess like other maybe investors would say, especially at our stages, because, you know, for us, it's all about the founders and the founding team, right? Because, you know, business models evolve here and there, but, you know, the teams stay more or less, especially the CEO stays more or less the same, right? So you're backing him. I mean, if you look at also like in the NASDAQ, right, a lot of the best performing companies are founder led, you know, and continue to perform better. So it's simple green flags like this, right? And then maybe the red flags, I guess. Oh, I think it's a combination of things. It's, again, you need to put on a case by case, right? But maybe their first red flag is, I don't know, maybe their cap table or, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe they've given away too much equity and they've just, you know, messed up the cap table completely. And I don't know, it needs restructuring from Seed, right? That's not a good look. Or maybe even like, even a bit after that. Second thing is maybe, you know, how much money they've raised, you know, where they're at, the valuation entry point, things like that. I guess that's very important as well, especially when exits are at much lower ranges than I guess the US and Europe. So those are a few things, as well as, you know, what's their burn rate, right? I guess how much they're burning. I mean, how much, as they say, how much salaries are they taking, things like this. I mean, for me, I mean, I understand like founders have to have salaries as well here and there to, you know, support the family or, you know, them as an individual, right? But, you know, what's a fair amount, things like this. I mean, if you see a company taking like, you know, so much at pre-seed and seed, it's probably a bit of a red flag, right? From my point of view, then, you know, then a founder that has like, okay, more or less all equity and, you know, taking a bit here and there. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you mentioned there is the cap table. And I'm curious just from your side, when you, like, how would you define a messy cap table and what would be some of the approaches or strategies that you would take in trying to either consolidate that if you're interested in making an investment in the company and once you do, thinking about how to, you know, quote unquote, clean it up more or less.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could talk about in different stages, right? So, I mean, as I say, the first stage would be, you know, pre-seed, right? I always tell my founders and things like this, why don't we try build this like superstar angel group, right? So, you know, as I say, sometimes even before they have a cap table. So, you know, why don't you get an expert in marketing? Why don't you get an expert in fundraising? Why don't you get an expert in product, you know, in tech, so that, you know, as you're growing this company, you have five or six advisors you can just go to with more or less free advice, right? And you get them in at whatever ticket size. I guess that's how they craft the cap table early. And I guess like later, you know, it sort of depends, right? But we mainly focus from pre-seed to series A. That's pre-seed and seed predominantly, but then we have some opportunity deals a bit later, right? I mean, for example, at the fund, we did series A for HD, right? I brought that to the fund as well. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, at seed, at series A, it could be a combination of things. I mean, you know, how much does the founder own? You know, how much does investors own? How much do the angels own? And then just, I guess, cleaning it up. Like, you know, for example, if you're doing a price round and then you have this fund at maybe series A or something that is looking to invest, you know, a certain amount and own like 10, 20%, maybe 20, 25% of the company, or even around that range, right? 15, 20, let's say. And then, you know, they might take a board seat. Is there any opportunity that to have angels that, you know, got in the friends and family to that own a larger portion? If they're not going to help that much going forward, is there a way we can like, you know, offer sec, like, as I say, you know, sell their allocation, obviously, with them, like in secondaries or something, and then they can buy it out, right? And then, you know, the new fund could be better optics for the company, and it could be better for the founders as well as also the angel investor, as they get an exit with a good return, and then the fund could sort of hit their percentages they want to hit. So yeah.
Oh, sorry, I was just on mute there.
All good.
Yeah, I think, yeah, so one thing I also wanted to touch on here is you mentioned about how TAV is quite focused, or is becoming more focused on emerging markets. Ah. And you've done 200 or so investments so far. Is it right? Mostly at the Series A level, is that correct?
No, pre-seed and seed, actually. Oh. As I say, okay. 220 investments in pre-seed and seed. But yeah, look, I mean, like, as I say, like, for example, right, predominantly the fund is actually 50% of the focus is US, 30% is around, you know, Europe, and 10 to 20% is, you know, rest of the world, Southeast Asia.
How do you kind of think about, you know, rest of the world, right? Like, how do you guys do that kind of like top-down analysis on like which countries you want to focus on? I'd be really curious on that. That's like a very interesting, interesting. There's so many countries to choose from, right? In that EM space.
I can maybe share some countries I'm excited for as well, right? You know, in terms of with TAV and myself personally as well, right? I mean, let's talk about maybe, you know, a bit about sort of our approach and what we look for. So, you know, obviously very excited for Southeast Asia. You know, the first, you know, I've led three deals with the fund, brought three deals with them and worked on that. I mean, one was in India, one was in Thailand, and one was in Indonesia, right? So I think you can see there's an Asia focus I'm trying to bring in. But some of the markets, I guess it depends, right? I think for us, we look at key data points, you know, sort of like not just what the risk reward scenario of that market is, but, you know, what, for example, things like GDP or in the country, you know, the growth rate, startup funding available, you know, what successes have come out of that country, the geopolitical landscape, you know, so we look at multiple factors, right? And I'll maybe give you a few countries I'm excited for. You know, one country I'm really excited for is company. I don't know, is obviously a country like Bangladesh, right? I mean, if you look at Bangladesh, you know, Bangladesh is, I think, one of the fastest growing economies globally, like I think because last year or something, maybe them in Vietnam or something like that. But if you look at Bangladesh, right, it's sort of a market that is very, very early in terms of funding. You know, we've seen a few big successes. No, we haven't seen like that much, like massive, massive successes, but we've seen like, you know, decent ones, right?
I saw Prio Shop recently. It had a $5 million raise.
So we just raised, I mean, I'm advisor to Prio Shop as well, I guess, right? In terms of, but, you know, they just closed a round, their Series A, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, I went before that, but in terms of, that's a company I'm very excited for. I mean, back to the points about the data, you know, Bangladesh has one of the highest not just like, as I say, the highest like younger population in the world as well. And, you know, I think Bangladesh has massive, massive population as well in terms of not just that, but the age as well, the people under 30. So, you know, what does that mean, right? You know, they're very tech savvy. You know, the online internet penetration rate is very high. Everyone's using mobile. So that's always good signs, right? So I think the data points will show that Bangladesh is heading in the right direction, right? But I guess time will tell if, you know, that makes the most sense, right? And then, so yeah, I'm excited on Bangladesh. I mean, another market I'm quite excited for is obviously Thailand, you know, being in Thailand, right? Would you classify Thailand as an emerging market? I guess, you know, people can look at it from two point of views. Thailand, as they say, has one of probably the highest, if not, actually, no, apart from Singapore and Malaysia, right? I think the GDP per capita is next. But Thailand has one of the most highest average revenue per users, relatively no startup competition, but high conglomerate competition, right? If you compare it to like another market like Indonesia or something, sort of the opposite, right? I mean, you know, you have like so much startup competition, you know, but you have really low average revenue per user, things like this, right? So I guess for me, although I'm very excited for Indonesia as well, I've done some deals in Indonesia, Thailand, the risk reward is just very, very strong, right? I mean, because I mean, the middle class inflection point, we are there already. And we are just going to keep growing and growing. The only thing I'd say, Thailand has quite an aging population, but I guess that means that, you know, an area like healthcare could be a big focus, right? And could be a big area that, you know, drives GDP to that next income bracket. So yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the other thing to obviously keep in mind, I guess, is that like you do get 30 million tourists a year. So that does help with keeping the demographics kind of in shape in terms of spending.
Correct. Exactly. I mean, like Thailand's very exciting. I mean, like Thailand sort of traditionally, I mean, with funding and things like this, right? I feel like, you know, there was actually an article or like a report on Thailand and the funding ecosystem. And it was very, people were saying like, oh, you know, which is true, right? And I saw it as well. I mean, I've always saw that there's a funding gap in Thailand. You know, you have these angels that do like 10, 20K ticket sizes. And then you have these like funds that do like, oh no, sorry, not even funds, CVCs, which are like 3, 4, 5 million, right? You don't really have anyone in that middle to fill that gap of like 100 to 200, 300K, right? And to make that ecosystem really work, you gotta, you know, have that sort of like pipeline, right? Of, you know, the angel, the small fund, and then, you know, the larger fund, right? So, but actually it's put Thailand in a good position because I think in the long term, it will be beneficial for Thailand because Thailand has always been a market that is very hard to raise money. You know, I always make the joke that, if we can raise money in Thailand, we can raise money anywhere, you know, because we, you know, so like raising money in Thailand is like the equivalent of, I don't know, raising like 4 or 5X in like, you know, like Singapore or US or something, right? This, right? So, I mean, so Thai founders have always, not just Thai founders, but founders that are building in Thailand have just always had it a bit more, I guess, harder in terms of raising money and, you know, having to do more with less. But what does that mean? I mean, as an investor, I think that's, you know, good, right? I mean, like, for example, if they're, you know, getting to profitability much quicker, I mean, they've always been focused on profitability. So when like there was a market downturn, right? Although it did hit the impact, like did hit quite a lot of companies, there were some founders that were just continuing building and they were like, hey, oh, the markets, like the valuations of the like companies in our sector have gone down. I'm like, oh yeah, they're valued at this. And then you're like, oh, but in Thailand, we're valued already at a similar amount, right? Just because Thailand has this emerging market discount. So which I don't think they should have it as high, right? So yeah, but that's an opportunity for us investors. So yeah.
Yeah, just a few follow-ups on that. Like I think of what you mentioned earlier about like, you know, the investing in a crypto company, I think that was probably at the time when it was very consensus, right? To be investing in crypto. And so
it was more of a back on the founder, you know, the bet on the founder here, you know, because I mean, yeah. The founder, yeah, he built, he was one of the co-founders of Starling Bank in the UK.
Okay. Yeah.
So like, you know, he's built a very big business, right? So, or like one of the, like,
the reason I was mentioning that is because I think on that end, right, it's like, you know, that there are always going to be areas that are really hot, that are really exciting. But then on the other end of it, when you talk about this kind of risk reward, right? So when you look at somewhere like maybe Indonesia or Vietnam, maybe the risk reward isn't quite the same as Thailand because it's quite consensus, right? So for investing in, let's say, e-commerce in Indonesia and Vietnam right now, you know, that the valuations would be very high. But Thailand, on the other hand, and also from our side, when we got going with launching Satori Giants, we were really excited for Thailand as well because of this, because of our experience also in Cambodia. Cambodia is a complete underdog.
in the market, right, which just has like a lot of potential, but you know, it's just like very, 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 very early innings.
Right. And it's also like which countries can be a springboard. And I think Thailand, you know, does have that potential. And I think what you also mentioned about how, and we've talked to a few founders about this, and you know, there is that you can quite easily raise the pre-seed money, the angel money. Then if you want to stay in Thailand, focus on Thailand, you may only have like the corporate VCs to look at, but these businesses that start in Thailand, then scaling kind of regionally and then taking capital from wherever they may. I think that's a really exciting opportunity. Do you see that with the founders right now in Thailand? Are they seeing it as like a launch pad and then it's go regional, or is it just let's focus on Thailand?
I mean, I guess it depends on the company, right? It depends on, can this be a regional play? I mean, obviously it can be a regional play. It's very exciting. But I think what we're also seeing a lot of is, you know, companies that actually, you know, getting to more or less profitable break even, right? So it's like, you know, they can raise on their own terms. So, I mean, do they actually need to do a funding round? And if the funding round is purely just for expansion, right? So in the other hand, I am seeing some of that as well. But I mean, Thailand's already just a big, big enough market. I mean, we have a population of 70 million people. And it's, as I can say, and the spending power is very high, right? So I know, as they say, you know, it's quite a bit of this in Bangkok, but I mean, a lot of these businesses are being built in Bangkok, right? But then, yeah, I mean, look, regional plays are, you know, you're seeing companies are exciting as well. I mean, obviously HD, for example, they're in Thailand right now, but, you know, they're in Indonesia as well. A small part of their business is in Indonesia, and I think they plan to go to other markets later, right? So, yeah, I think we can see that, but I guess it depends on, you know, does it make sense for the company, right? So, yeah.
So maybe on the other end of that, it would be interesting to just actually understand which markets are you like sort of contrarian on, right? Like the ones that maybe there is too much focus and you actually think of like already maybe peaked.
I was quite contrarian and on actually, like, I guess taking the approach of, I've always said like Thailand since 2021, right? You know, I was like, okay, Thailand, the data doesn't lie, right? I mean, like, and they say it's showing it's heading in the right direction, but you know, I sort of saw, wait, why is funding not as except like, you know, readily available, right? But people said like, you know, geopolitical things and things like this. But I guess living in this country, growing up in this country, and like, you know, building a strong network in this market, I mean, I would see, you know, the geopolitical landscape in like, you know, Thailand and other markets are, if not similar. So why does Thailand have this massive discount, you know? So anyways, you know, that I guess that sort of, you know, mismatch, right, was an opportunity for us investors, right? Where if another investor wouldn't want to go into this market, I mean, for us, if the data points show market, I mean, live in the country, blah, 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 things like this, then it makes sense, right? So that's an example one. I think Bangladesh was probably another one as well. People were very, I guess, against a lot, I mean, as they say, but it's still very early, you know, but Bangladesh as well, starting to get exciting here and there. I mean, people are like saying, oh, you know, so just back India, right? You know, let's just do India instead. But I mean, look, I mean, I think it's back to the point of the risk reward, right? What is your entry point and where are you planning to exit, right? I mean, you probably saw a lot of companies in India. You know, I mean, I spoke to some founders and they want to raise at really high valuations as well. So for me, the risk reward doesn't justify that high valuation, right? Because one, has India has these, like, they've had massive outcomes, but it's like, have they had like European and US outcomes to really justify that, you know, that high, you know, pre-seed or seed valuation, even series A, right? So yeah, I mean, because for us investors, you know, our job is to return capital to our, you know, to our LPs or other investors, right? So yeah.
Great. And I think heading on into maybe just more of a more like a macro perspective. I know we've been talking about a lot of the excitement of areas that you're seeing in Bangladesh and Thailand and some of the, like, the contrarian opinions as well. You know, I think, you know, as we've discussed before, there's been a recent decline in funding since 2021, and there's more of this pressure on startups to, you know, basically show a clear path to profitability. You know, overall, just from your perspective, how do you anticipate the VC landscape evolving in the near future, especially in a region like Southeast Asia, where there's going to be this massive, considerable growth that's still going to occur over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So look, I mean, I think that's the beauty of emerging markets, right? We sort of see what happens in, I guess, the rest of the world, you know, the developed markets, and we sort of, you know, 5-10 years later, sort of evolves into the emerging markets, right? We've seen this multiple times. But look, I think in general, I mean, some of the things I'm just, I guess, with the firstly on the fundraising landscape, I mean, things are, you know, things are starting to pick up now. I mean, you and I know this sort of, you know, started in 2021 and things like this, whenever, you know, the markets were at its peak. And then obviously with interest rates, things like this, it sort of happened in the US, and then multiples and publics really went down, and then that affected private, right? Because the late stage private, they need IPO, right? Or they need M&A, right? So if the buyer, you know, if this public company doesn't have cash to do the M&A, or as they say, their multiple's been hammered, like, and their multiple has been contracted, and, you know, they're down 60, 70%, 80%, which a lot of growth companies were, you know, why is this private worth this, right? So I mean, I think it's a combination of things. So that's just one thing. But I mean, in Southeast Asia, I think funding is starting to pick up. I mean, it was definitely been slow. I think, you know, the growth as much, I'm not very interested in too much. The Series B, Series C, Series D onwards, you know, in emerging markets. But I think pre-seed to Series A, I think massive opportunity, right? Providing the right entry point. I think that matters a lot, because, I mean, in Southeast Asia, right, the last, I think, you know, one of the big exits was like 2C2P, right? And that was like 500 million, you know, so, and that, you know, was a while back, right? So will we see that? I mean, I think we'll see more of those than, like, you know, $5 or $10 billion companies in Southeast Asia. Therefore, like, you know, if you want to go and not like at 100 mil, 200 mil, right? If you want to generate like 10, 20, 30, 40, 50X, you know, you should try going like, I don't know, sub 15 or something. For me, I would love to go in like sub 15, sub 10, sub 5, even if I can, right? I mean, it just depends, because, yeah, I mean, think about it. If you get in a company at like 2 or 3, you exit at like, I don't know, 40, 50, it's still done really well, right? And the chance of it is much better than, I guess, a company you go in at like 50 and, you know, you exit like, I don't know, 1.5 or 2 billion. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's why the early stage is so exciting, right? That's.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, because I guess the beauty of this, right, is that, you know, for me, I'm really, you know, extremely like grateful that, you know, I can meet all these great founders and things like this every day, right? And speak to them and say, hey, you know, they're all building these, like, have these goals of building this massive, solving this massive problem, right? Whether it's like making healthcare more affordable, you know, insurance more accessible, or even like, you know, places where there's no, as you say, in the fintech side, unbanked, make the unbanked more, you know, bankable, things like this, right? So, I mean, and you get to like see, and, you know, you get to maybe get in some brilliant businesses at, you know, ground zero and watch them grow and help them, right? So I think, yeah, that's a really cool thing about venture, and, you know, I'm happy I'm able to do it. So yeah.
Well, talked a lot about your experience in venture. You know, one thing that we do want to hear a little bit about too is you're not only just a VC, but you also have a bit of career working on Slay Zone. And so it would be great to tell us a little bit more about what's going on there, what's keeping you busy.
Yeah. So look, I mean, as I say, I mean, I guess my day job is venture, right? I mean, you know, but for me, I mean, as I say, very consumer focused person, right? So I guess, you know, it's not, I would say, you know, I got a good opportunity, and, you know, as I say, coming from this media background, because as you say, my family and my sister, right? You know, I was like privileged to be able to do these things, or, you know, grateful to get these opportunities. So I think it's just like, and as you, because it's like sort of, it's rare to find this tech and media combination, right? Okay. Especially in venture. Because I mean, you and I know venture is probably one of the, like, the most hardest industries to get into and, you know, build in that area, right? Just based on, you know, everything. But also, you know, so it's like, how can you be unique? And if you already have an edge, how do you have even a greater edge, right? So it's just crafting this out. And so, yeah, I sort of thought tech and media was the angle. I mean, the media side was never really what I thought about, but look, it was an opportunity. And, you know, continue to actually do a few projects here and there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can grow that media side, you know, and you have that tech angle, it's very hard to compete, right? And I guess that's sort of my long-term goal with that. But obviously, you know, do great projects, work with great people, work with great angles. And, you know, you have your sort of like investor side, and then you have also your other side as well, right? So it's good to have like a combination. So yeah, that's a bit about that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, the fun side, we'll call it, right?
No, it's, come on, it's a bit like it's more like you know, it's in a way I think it helps, right? Because both sides, meaning if you go on like podcasts and stuff like this, if you do films and you know. And, you know, you have that, not just the distribution side, which I think is massive. You know, mm-hmm. if you can leverage, you can build a good distribution side. Plus you can also, you know, you have that also experience at, you know, being more, I guess, confident on the camera. You know, you go on podcasts, you go to public speaking and things like this. They all play hand in hand, right? So I guess for me, it's just, it was an opportunity I couldn't refuse. And then, you know, combining the tech and media is just like very rare to have. So yeah, that's sort of a bit about that.
Yeah, entirely agree. I mean, you know, with Rising Giants on our side, we've been building it for about 3.5 years now, and it's just such a rewarding and enjoying feeling being able to, and also very, very humbling experience to speaking with so many different founders coming from so many different backgrounds, also investors too. But you know, you really get to learn about so many different people. So many different perspectives, and like being on the interviewer side, it's really enjoyable to kind of sit back and listen and really take in what, you know, people's perspectives are. And, you know, Max and I always talk about how valuable that is. And, you know, as time goes on, right, that there are other opportunities and doors and things like that do open up.
Yeah. But
having that genuine curiosity and interest too is so valuable to have.
So, yeah. I mean, I'm totally with you on that, right? I mean, like, as I say, people, you know, as you say, if you're always curious and, you know, you always want to, I guess, try different things, do new things and things like that. And then, you know, I think a lot of them will be quite connected as, you know, the things you choose and stuff like this. And if you can sort of find that combination, it's just really, really good, right? Because, you know, you do what you love. So, yeah, look, I mean, especially when you're young, right? I mean, you know, it's good to try out multiple things, and not just that, but also, as I say, if you want to build something unique, you should try, okay, if this fits and if someone else doesn't have this edge, you know, you could, like, that's your advantage, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, those next steps in that journey become more and more organic. So,
sure. Investors and things like this is all heading down the media approach, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you and I know every fund here, they have their sort of like, content creation, right? You always get the article and things like this, you know. So I mean, it's like building your own, in a way, your own engine, the same way you and I know that. So if you have that combination of the media angle and from a personal basis, it's like you're, you know, you have that competitive edge over like some funds even, mm-hmm. you know, on distribution, leveraging this and things like this, which it's very hard to compete, right? So yeah, for me, it's all about the experience and, as they can say, building that engine, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've built that engine with Rising Giants, you know, you've been able to have a, you know, start your own mini accelerator fund, whatever you want to call it, right? I guess if you have that engine, you can do what you want with it, right? And, you know, these other guys that have much more capital to play with, you're still able to compete on the same playing field, mm-hmm. just based on having that media engine. So,
and speaking of media, you know, what are some of the podcasts or even outside of media, books that either you really like to read or have influenced you either from on the personal side or a business side?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's for me, I'm someone who's always like quite curious, right? I like to read a lot, whether it's articles, numbers, data, you know, things like this. I mean, look, I mean, I spent like the last few years looking at pitch decks, right? Like more on the investor side, so I've probably seen like over 1,000. So kind of got used to that side, right? But I mean, getting all these things, reading all these things, you know, macro reports, things like this, right? It's just super, you know, interesting to me. You know, latest technology trends, you know, Substacks, articles, things like this, reads. I mean, some of the ones I read quite a lot is on the article side. You probably know like Digital Native by Rex Woodbury. He's a guy I think is very sharp. And then on the podcast side, there's one I really respect. It's called Turpentine VC. Those guys are really, really smart. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously you have the usual Olden Pod and the 20VC, right? But I guess that's probably a lot of people watch it now. But to Turpentine VC, I think it's quite under the radar. And they bring in quite a lot of good guests. And yeah, I mean, they have good conversations, right? And, you know, for me, as a young investor as well, it's good to learn from these people who have been in the industry for like 30, 40 years. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, as we close out the episode, our traditional closing question that we like to ask each of our guests is, what is the greatest piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Okay. So I think in terms of, there's a few, right? I think in terms of that have really stuck by me, but maybe I'll just pick one. One that I guess is, you know, I learned from a young age growing up is that, you know, is that to always take moonshots whenever you're young, right? As I say, go as big as possible. And, you know, because if it works, then great, brilliant. If it doesn't work, you learn a really important lesson very, very early, more earlier than others, right? So I guess that's sort of the aspect I look at things, right? As I say, if it works, brilliant. If it doesn't work, I learn it way earlier than others. So yeah, that's, I would say is, you know, if you get an opportunity, try to go as big as possible. If it works, it's a great outcome for you, maybe your family. And if it doesn't work, then you learn a very valuable lesson, right? Probably 10 or 20 years earlier than anyone else. So yeah.
So note to self, I'm going to 50x leverage every trade that I make.
Maybe not that. Maybe you got to calculate the thing.
Only the moonshot. Right?
You know what I mean, right? I mean, like, as I say, like for example, Rising Giants, right? You could, right. You have this outcome to be this like leading media company in, I don't know, frontier markets or whatever, right? That could be the grand vision, you know, and then sort of you can sort of be this media arm where you do like multiple things, podcasts, movies, series, I don't know, right? In terms of a bunch of things. And then you have this like, so you sort of build this, you know, so that could be maybe the grand vision, right? I mean, what is your guys' grand vision of Rising Giants? I mean, go big, right?
Right, right. Well, you know, to be honest, I've been told I have a face for radio, so I don't know about the TV shows and movies, but we'll stick with the podcast.
All right, podcast will be a starting point, and we'll see you on you know, CBS or sometime soon.
Right, exactly. Well, Richard, we really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on Rising Giants. So we have the pulse on the title.